Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I get a reminder that we Zoom the night before, but as you've come to expect, we begin every single show we have since March with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. And I am going to take a point of personal privilege, and I'm going to recommend that you go to my Facebook page because I will link to the Atlantic Monthly story today, that is Monday, a story landed by Jeffrey Goldberg. Alexander Vindman, Trump is Putin's useful idiot. In his first interview, a key witness in the impeachment trial says, Trump goes out of his way to try to please the Russian president. So I'm going to ask forgiveness for my first guest because I just want to read the opening sentences of this Atlantic Monthly story, and then I'm going to beg you to read the whole damn thing. Shortly after midnight on June 17th, 1972, an unusually attentive security guard named Frank Willis discovered an unlocked door in the garage of the Watergate office complex. A piece of tape had been placed over the latch. Wills removed the tape and continued on his rounds. When he returned a while later, he found the locked tape again. He called the police. 26 months later, Richard Nixon resigned the presidency. This is the door, I tell Alexander Vindman, later the United States Army and National Security Council. Vindman and I were supposed to be walking along the Potomac, but we took a detour to visit the Watergate. I wanted to show him this particular door. There is no plaque here, but there should be one, dedicated to the Constitution, to the free press, and to the most important security guard in American history. Vindman, who is an idealist, this is why he took the job at the Trump White House, despite having read about the Trump White House, seemed moved. The system worked, he said. Then he asked a question. Who am I in the Watergate story? John Dean? Dean, Nixon's lawyer, facilitated the Watergate cover-up and then turned witness against the president. No, I said. Dean did wrong before he did right. Did you start by doing something wrong? I did my duty as an American citizen and an American officer, Vindman said. If that's the case, I think that you're Frank Wills of the Trump impeachment. All you did was tell your colleagues that you may have witnessed a crime in progress. Anyway, Vindman is now what you need to hear from 2019. You will hear him every single day until the election. Keep that voice ringing in your ears as you exercise the franchise.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear, for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I saw a piece at 5:38. And the piece brought so many pieces of my life and past interviews together that I realized I needed to reach out to our guest. The title of the piece was How Trump and COVID-19 Have Reshaped the Modern Militia Movement. Amelia Thompson DeVoe is the person who wrote this piece, and I want to welcome her to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, Amelia.
Thanks for having me.
I've already complimented her on how great a writer she is, so I'm going to definitely recommend that you read every single sentence of her piece. But I don't know if you ever read the book On Tyranny by Professor Snyder from Yale University. Have you ever read that book? It's a little tiny book. And before he wrote the book, he wrote a blog post in 2016, right around the time that Donald Trump got elected. And in the blog post that I interviewed that eventually became the book, it was entitled 20 Lessons from the 20th Century on How to Survive in Trump's America. And the reason I am going to grab a little tiny nugget from that blog post that eventually becomes a book is that it relates directly to what you wrote about Amelia. And so he's giving us these 20 lessons, things we have to pay attention to. And this is number 17. Number 17 says the following: watch out for the paramilitaries. When the men with guns, who have always claimed to be against the system, start wearing uniforms and marching around with torches and pictures of a leader, the end is nigh. When the pro-leader paramilitary and the official police and military intermingle, the game is over. This was written, Amelia, in 2016, actually. And as I was reading your piece about the modern militia movement, it just brought that number 17 back to me. So let's talk about this militia movement, because it is not generic. One size doesn't fit all. You wrote about a little bit historically and then sort of looked at where it's going today, in part because social media has actually kind of enhanced the militia movement, because everyone who thinks that they want to be in a militia can find one that fits their flavor du jour. So I love the piece, and let's sort of talk a little bit about why you decided to write this and really what you began to sort of connect the dots.
Yeah, so thanks so much for your kind words about the piece. I should say I co-wrote it with my amazing colleague, Maggie Kurth, who's a science writer at 538. And I mean, the reason we really wanted to write it was that I'm a politics writer, Maggie's a science writer. We've both done a fair amount of work on the impact of political rhetoric and extremism, and sort of trying to understand what makes extremist violence happen and what's the connection to what's happening in our political moment and what political leaders are saying. And we had both been struck by the fact that militias were sort of making their way into the national scene and the national conversation in a bunch of different ways this year. I mean, even before the pandemic started, there were a number of militia members who showed up in Richmond, Virginia in January as part of a gun rights protest. So, you know, this is something that was kind of in the national, in the air, even before the pandemic hit. But, you know, we've seen people who are part of militias show up at reopening protests. And then over the course of the summer at the racial injustice protests across the country, militia members have appeared in, you know, sort of a variety of different contexts in ways that were often kind of confusing and hard to figure out why they were there. And then when the events happened in Kenosha, and it appeared that Kyle Rittenhouse, the shooter, might have some kind of connection to a militia. It wasn't clear how. It wasn't clear if he was a member of a militia or he was, you know, sort of a militia enthusiast, or if he was just very pro-police and there were other militia members out there that night, and he sort of found his you know, he found himself among them. It just wasn't
his people. He found his people. I mean, that's really what this is.
But
this
isn't about membership.
It's about identity, and he identified with this group and sought to find them.
Right, but we wanted to know who those people were, because it seemed like, you know, okay, people are showing up with guns on the streets of American cities in response to protests, and people died in Kenosha because of that. And so we wanted to understand sort of how does this fit with what we know about what militias have been historically, and how that may have transformed in this incredibly unique and chaotic moment we're in.
You, in your piece, you really start talking about the sort of the rise of the militia, or the concept of it, in the late 80s, okay? And right into the 90s. Do you know why that completely just rang a bell? I used to be a radio talk show host in White River Junction, Vermont. This is before public radio even existed. It was a conservative station, but I was the Saturday morning 3-hour talk show host. And I was known as a liberal in the Upper Valley of Vermont and New Hampshire. And I would talk a lot about guns, because I would be upset because we didn't have any really gun control or gun laws. And one day there was an opening of a new shopping mall in Lebanon, and I was asked to bring my show to the shopping mall. Guess who showed up at the show? The White Mountain Militia. And I am on the air And these guys are literally marching in front of my table at the opening of the shopping mall, obviously to intimidate and threaten me. So what I did, Amelia, which sort of tells you a little bit about me, was I was sharing with my radio audience exactly what was happening as it was happening. I would describe who was walking. I described the ammunition. I described everything. And I said, I think they're trying to intimidate me. So let me document everything they're doing as I'm on the air. Now, the reason I share, this is 1989, okay? This is 1989. So as I read your piece and I saw you're seeing the rise, I've been following these boys for a long time. They know me and I know them. And what is so interesting is that what I was able to do with my radio show is now something that social media can do, because we didn't have social media. We didn't have the internet. So while they may have had a presence, and in 1995, there was a really interesting article in the New York Times about the militia and New Hampshire and the Upper Valley in New York and Vermont. But I think what social media has done is given them a bigger geographical footprint and an opportunity to find more, I'm not going to call them crazies, but more sort of fanatics that really identified with them. And that's what's so scary, is when I saw them, it was a small group of individuals. I knew who they were, but now I'm more afraid because you don't know who they are and you don't know who is sort of figuring out that they have an affinity. And even though they may not sign up and are on this list, they think they are because it's in their head.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting as we were talking to experts. I asked them, a few of them, about the role of social media, and they pointed out that some of these groups were actually, they were much earlier adopters of social media than I had known. And they were on the internet very early. And actually, you know, at the moment you're describing, in the 80s, online organizing, such as it was something they were already taking advantage of. But I think you're absolutely right that the sort of role social media has now, and the way that people can just kind of explore online and discover groups and find people who share a similar ideology and organize around them, that is something that is changing, and particularly is changing in the pandemic when we're spending so much time online and there's such a feeling of uncertainty. And people are sort of looking for meaning in a moment when it sort of feels like the world is descending into chaos almost. And what we know from experts on extremism is that all of those feelings of fear and anxiety and precarity, that leads people toward extremist ideologies because those ideologies offer certainty. And so when you combine that with people feeling, you know, very much on the brink, and then also spending all this time online, and these groups often organize online, then it's easier for people who, you're right, aren't necessarily card-carrying members of the paramilitary groups that have meetings and trainings and membership dues, but are sort of interested in aspects of it, whether it's you know, white supremacy, which is a part of the militia movement, but not all of it, or pro-gun rights, or other anti-government ideologies. They can kind of, it's like, one of the experts said, it's kind of like a choose your own adventure. You find your people, and then because they're just showing up in the streets, that's how we end up with a situation where there are all these heavily armed people and it's unclear what exactly ties them together. And the answer is maybe not much.
Well, let me do, before we go, Ken, let me just say something, Ken. And that is that what I love about the fact that you can sort of show up. You don't have to definitely have a membership card. You haven't been to any meetings. So in a way, it gives these militia groups the ability to embrace when it serves their purpose, or walk away when it serves their purpose. So, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse, you know, was he a member? Who knows? Are they going to accept it? No, because he did something horrific. He killed two people, you know? And I think that's what's really scary about this, is that at least in the olden days, when I was sort of really following the militia, they kind of knew their peeps, you know what I mean? And they actually sort of were very proud of membership. What I think is really interesting here is that I feel membership is like an accordion. You know, it can be as big as they want it to be or as small as they want it to be. And they get to decide. But, you know, they can't stop people from showing up because in part that sort of adds to that, you know, that adventure concept. You know, they want to be the adventure that someone wants to follow, because even if they're not part of the militia at that moment, maybe they will be a future member of that militia. So why stop them? Ken, you wanted to weigh in?
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask Amelia about what ties you see between current day militia people and the sort of white nationalist extremists. They've been around forever. You know, they didn't start under Trump and they didn't start in the 1980s. You know, there were people, the gun people and the white nationalists and the skinheads and everybody living in Idaho out in the wilderness with their rifles and having Nazi rallies or paramilitary rallies. You know, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been documenting them since they started throughout the country. And I'm wondering really, you know, when you were talking about social media, I think that maybe what social media did was it gave a lot of opportunity for those folks all over the country to get together more. I know what you're doing. You know what I'm doing. Let's coordinate our actions. You have a better weaponry than I do. You know, how can I get access to the more killing quality weaponry and all of that? And then Charlottesville was where they came out of the closet, I guess, and showed publicly what they'd been involved in online, that we're all together and this is a much huger operation than y'all thought and you better be scared of us. For some of us, that was kind of eye-opening. So I'm just wondering what you think of tying all of that history together with the current, what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's really complicated. And I mean, I guess one of the points that the experts made is that, you know, the folks who are affiliated with these movements or with this movement have a lot of different ideologies. And so the white supremacy movement, as we know it today, and I think, you know, you can sort of debate some folks who study this would say, you know, the modern militia movement really began in the late 70s and sort of moved into the 80s and 90s. And other people would say, you know, well, the KKK was a militia and sort of, so the definitions here are all contested and you can have a really interesting separate conversation about what a militia even is. But white, the, you know, sort of the white nationalist movement grew up as part of this modern militia movement. But it's not the whole thing. And I think one of the things that's really interesting and important about the movement is that, like, these groups don't all agree with each other. And some of them are even kind of directly opposed to each other. At least they will position themselves as being that way. And some groups will say, you know, like, no, we really don't agree with what the white nationalists are doing. Like, we're out here for gun rights. And we wrote in the piece, you know, that's complicated because it doesn't mean that the people who are part of the non-white nationalist militias don't hold racist views. They may, many do, but the ideology of white nationalism isn't what's driving them. And what one of the experts I talked to said is that what he's seen much more prominently recently is the very strong anti-government strain. And that the sort of the white nationalist militias, we were seeing more of them back in 2017, obviously a lot of them showed up in Charlottesville, but that this year it's been much more about, you know, the lockdown protests and saying, you know, you don't have a right to tell me I can't get a haircut, you know, and also showing up and protecting property. I'm putting that in air quotes because, you know, in a lot of cases, it's very unclear if the property owners actually ask the people with guns to show up and stand outside their property with guns. But that's been a sort of a so-called like a justification for showing up to the racial injustice protests. That's kind of, you know, it's not related to the actual content of the protests. It's saying, you know, like, no, we have this libertarian sense that we have the right to take our guns and protect our community and protect our property. And I think that's why this message is so appealing to so many people and especially to young men, that it's really a narrative of come out and protect your community. There's this threat. The threat can be defined in so many different ways, but you have a role to play. You can come out and be in this protector role. And I think that's how many of the people who are, you know, we're seeing out in the streets in the past few months are seeing their part in everything that that's been unfolding.
We're talking with Amelia Thompson DeVoe from 538. And Amelia, the thing that just makes me crazy is what Lawrence Rosenthal, who's the chair and lead researcher at the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies at the University of California, said, with Trump, the fringe entered the mainstream. And what is so interesting about what you're describing is that Donald Trump is perfect for them, because here is a president that is anti-government. And that's, in a lot of ways, they found their poster president, because he fits exactly, he elevates them. And therefore, if they're anti-government, he is their echo chamber. He legitimizes their anger about government because he seems to be saying the same thing, even though he is the government. I mean, Donald Trump is a smorgasbord. He gets to pick the government he wants when he wants it and reject the government when he wants to reject it. And in a lot of ways, that's what makes it so frightening, is because we're not only looking at a pandemic, we're not only looking at the fact that people are now armed to the teeth. People don't buy one gun. They buy more ammunition than you could possibly imagine, and they have an armory under their bed. And they now can find each other. Donald Trump has elevated their anger and their frustration. COVID has given them too much time to play in their head. And now Donald Trump is talking about an election that he is already raising questions about, and even suggesting that he may need their help, whatever their help means. And that's what makes this story so incredibly terrifying, because I don't know what holds them together, but in an interesting way, Amelia, I think it's Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump is a Rorschach test. He's whatever you want, because he lies about everything and he tries to be on everyone's side, but you're not quite sure which. So therefore, if he calls to you, you think that you need to respond. Whether you're a white supremacist, whether you're a Second Amendment person, whether you're a libertarian, whether you're anti-government, whether you don't want to be told you can't, you know, go to a bar, he gives you every reason to follow him. Am I wrong?
I think you're certainly right that Donald Trump has kind of created a kind of inflection point for this movement, because militias were very active under President Obama, but it was very much a sort of anti-government, opposition to the president, opposition to what the federal government was doing. You know, I think Americans are very good at saying they're anti-government and then immediately kind of breaking that down and compartmentalizing it. So like the idea that you're pro-military but anti-something else. So I don't think the idea that, you know, it's not that these folks were saying I'm anti-government and they were opposed to every part of the government, but it was much more, they were certainly opposed to the head of state. And that has changed under Trump. As Professor Rosenthal told me, Trump has really brought these themes and this rhetoric that were very much at the fringe into the mainstream. His talk about the deep state, his anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant rhetoric. It does seem like a lot of folks in this movement felt like he was speaking to them. And that has created this situation where one of our sources said, you know, instead of all of that energy being directed at the president and at the government, now some of that energy is directed at the people who President Trump is identifying as a threat, which includes this sort of amorphous idea of the radical left and Antifa. And so it raises the likelihood. I mean, I think, you know, when there are people out on the streets with guns, there's always likelihood that violence is going to happen. But it does, in some ways, raise the likelihood of violence erupting on the streets between American civilians.
And we're using the term government as if it's generic. Because what Donald Trump will do, he'll point to the Democratic mayors, bad government. He'll point to the Democratic governors, bad government. He'll talk to how he describes Biden and Harris as bad government. I mean, this is really interesting.
Describe them as if they're actually running the country.
Right, exactly. I am the good government. They are the bad government. So again, he is like this Rorschach test, because, you know, we keep thinking that they're anti-government, but I read at the very beginning that number 17 from the 20 lessons from Tim Snyder, and he is doing exactly that. He is blending this sort of paramilitary militia groups with his people, whatever his people are, you know, the guys that work for ICE, the guys that, I mean, it's getting in that way very scary. Your last paragraph is really important, Amelia. Until now, given the way things are changing, the people who study the militia movement and have spent years talking to its members think there's a risk of American militias becoming more like the militias of other, often politically unstable countries. Quote, what matters is, if the movement becomes essentially a more traditional Latin America pro-regime paramilitary, which seems to be what Trump is trying to create or wants, Churchill said. That last paragraph is exactly what I see happening. That's why I started with that lesson from Tim Snyder, you know, who wrote the book On Tyranny, because what he warned about in 2016 is what you are writing about right now, Amelia, and what these people who've been following the militias are seeing. And I think that is what is so terrifying. And we're looking at what's happening during this election. And as I said to someone the other day, Donald Trump has to lose not only in the polls, he has to lose on election day, and he has to lose after we collect all the absentee ballots and mail-in ballots. It's got to be a trifecta, because if he wins on any level, on any one of those things, it is then a license for him to stay and for those militias to begin to realize that their leader is calling on them. And that's what was so scary about your piece. It's incredibly well researched. You speak to the right people, but the answers they're giving me are terrifying, are terrifying. So I am grateful for you writing this, and I'm gonna definitely recommend that everybody go to 538 and check it out. And if nothing else, if they go to my Facebook page, they will read how Trump and COVID-19 have reshaped the modern militia movement. Researchers warn there may be more violence. And after reading your piece, I don't know how to prepare. And at some point, maybe that's your next piece. How do we prepare? How do we anticipate? What is an appropriate response if this is how they act? And that's the question I don't know how to answer. And maybe you can someday write a piece, or you'll give me some guidance and a roadmap. Anyway,
someday, I hope Amelia writes that piece within the next
38 hours. That's right. Amelia Thompson DeVoe, thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it. And it's a very powerful and well-researched piece. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
Child, don't you worry. It's enough you're growing up in such a hurry. Brings you down the news they sell you. To put in your mind that all mankind is a failure.
Welcome to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I just want to give people sort of a little backstory. We lost our guest literally as we were about to go on the air. And I was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And Ken says, call Bill Curry. And I went, of course, the best talker on the planet. And we called him and he said, can you give me 5 minutes? So I felt like saying, I'd give you 5 years. And sure enough, Bill Curry is joining us. Bill Curry was the Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He is a writer, he is a talker, he is a commentator, and someone who is just amazingly thoughtful about sort of the condition, I think, at this point of the human spirit, because so many of us, I think, Bill, are so devastated by everything we see, and it's not just politics, it's climate change, it's healthcare, it's the pandemic, it's the racism, it's just, oh my God, it's hard to get out of bed, I will be honest with you.
I'll just say to you that I had a day yesterday in which at the end of the day, it occurred to me that every conversation I had had with every friend or acquaintance over the course of the day had been therapeutic in nature, had been trying to talk people into seeing a better way. E.J. Dionne, whom I've always liked, had a nice line in a column. He said, "Hope isn't a feeling, it's a virtue." I've often said hope is a choice when people ask me if I'm hopeful. It's a choice we make each day. It's gotten harder to make, that's for sure.
Actually, I get it. I think I've told you this story. I was once listening to when I was about to run for Congress, and I'm listening to something on National Public Radio, and they're discussing baseball. I think I've been to one game in my life, so it's not exactly something that I'm zoning in on. But it's in the background, okay? It's the backdrop. And this guy is interviewing this expert on baseball, and he said, "So why are Americans so passionate about baseball?" And Bill, you'll love his answer. And they said, because they think their team's going to win, because they imagine themselves on the mound, and it's the place where they dream. Actually, it's the place where they practice hope. And he said that. And I was like, oh my God. And my ex-husband, who was actually sitting at the table, looked at me and said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "That's why I do politics. Because politics is the place where I practice hope." And it was this baseball interview that gave me the words and the understanding of why I did it. And this is the part of the story you'll love. So I'm being interviewed by a talk show host, and I tell this story, right, during the interview. What did my media team do? They clipped that interview that I did with the talk show host, telling the story about baseball and, you know, where I practice hope. And they made it into a radio ad for my running for governor. And you hear the sound of the organ, and you hear people cheering, and you hear the baseball bat hitting, and you hear me telling this story. And a radio station up north said, never in their life had people called up and said, "Would you run that advertisement again?" So they loved it. They loved it. So when you mentioned E.J. Dionne and the idea that hope is a virtue, I think he's right. It absolutely is. And it's harder to hold on to. Absolutely hard. So, William, I told you I wanted to start with a clothing story. You ready for my clothing story? So my daughter in China calls me last night and she says, "Mom, have you seen what's on the back of the Patagonia tags?" And I said, I hate to break it to you, honey bun, but I don't think I own anything Patagonia. And it's not exactly my sort of the thing I would purchase. She said, "Well, you better start purchasing it." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Let me send you a picture of what's on the back of the Patagonia tag." And on the back, it says, "Vote the a-holes out." That's what it says on the back of the Patagonia tag. So I posted that story on Facebook, and people are saying, "That's not true. Your daughter's making it up." So one of my friends from high school writes the following: "Corporate Patagonia offices are near me in Ventura. We know the founders and many who work there. I actually called my friend and asked, is this real? He said, it is." So there's my clothing story on the back of the Patagonia tags. We're all getting involved in this election, Bill Curry.
It's been interesting to watch since the tragic death of George Floyd, the number of corporations actually speaking out.
Yeah.
And the number of corporations sometimes speaking out more boldly than some of my political friends. You know, there are Democrats, I think, to be fair, are, in a way, the whole Democratic Party is punch drunk after a whole history of being, for all of its warts and blemishes, the principal agent for so much change. And even when they fail us, it's the agency out front on civil rights, on the environment, on gay rights, even as poorly as the elected officials behaved in it. And so I just see, you know, the one thing Democrats are is gun shy. and their opponents on the right are such incredible insult meisters. They're so good at smearing and attacking. They're constantly reactive in that way. And so, you know, Democrats open their door a crack and peek out before leaving the house in the morning. And you can feel it in how we approach issues. It's a funny thing to say, but it's really, really true. And the second thing I'll say is aggravating. And I said last time I was on the show, we all want politicians with the courage of their convictions, but it's a two-step process. First, get some convictions, you know, and then the courage that can come soon thereafter. And the fact that we're so message driven and so donor driven, we have so many reasons not to be clear, not to be concrete, not to put a bold plan on the table, even when that's what people are begging for. I just want to give a shout out to Bernie Sanders, who was so great coming out and just saying to Biden, and I got a couple of complaints from people I love calling to say, geez, can't Bernie just be on board for 2 more months? And I said, he is on board. And they said, why couldn't he just tell them? And I said, it doesn't work that way. I can tell you, having been inside a presidential campaign at the very heart of the 96 race, and then in other places, at other times in my life, inside both my own campaigns and a couple of presidential races, and being outside them, trying to get a message into a campaign, you're trying to convince all the people who are making the mistake that they're not making a mistake. They're obviously the hardest audience. And if they agree that they're making a mistake, they lose influence. The last thing they want to do is elevate some outsider in a way that discredits their own work. It's so hard to penetrate. And so Bernie did what you have to do. You have to get in the clippings. You have to make sure that morning the candidate is going to read directly the advice you give. It's the only way to advise a candidate who doesn't directly employ you. And so that, I did a great job, but it's so true. We talked about Biden going to Michigan with a kind of a Hillary-esque tax plan for manufacturing jobs. Tell him you did the auto bailout. Tell him you're for a minimum wage. Tell him they won't be able to screw unions from the moment you finally get this job. You'll fight to bring unions back in America, to bring back a middle class. And then tell them we're going to get them some health care. And then you can go home and you'll win the state. There's a set of simple economic justice, political reform. Economic justice, political reform. Don't just say the phrases, just give the examples. And we can take this thing like Grant took Richmond.
Well, I think Biden heard you, because apparently what Biden did was he talked a lot about the fact that, you know, we're looking at the fires and the climate change. Listen, let me tell you about the jobs that we can create. Let me tell you about the great union jobs we can create. He connected the fires and the devastation, and that there'll be, if you're worried in suburbia, you're not worried about racial fights. You're worried about being burned out, is what he said to them. I think he heard it. And this is what I actually tweeted out. I love you. So I tweeted this out. Bernie says that Biden should talk more about his economic plans. He may be right. There was a story at NPR. It was the Harvard team. It was about the Harvard team expected to find substantial economic damage. But this is much, much worse than I would have predicted. It was a financial pain from coronavirus pandemic. And they did a poll, and the poll said it was worse than they ever thought. People were hemorrhaging in ways they never expected. This poll was devastating to the people that were doing the polling, because it was so outside what they expected. And then you hear what Bernie said and telling Biden, you've got to talk about the economy. And you know what? He did. And that he connected the fires to jobs and unions was phenomenal, I think, Bill. So, you know, he delivered the right message at the right time, and he read the damn clippings.
I agree. And Biden, this isn't anything Biden can't do.
Yes.
And it's also, he doesn't have to do anything. This isn't about changing any positions or going any further to the left or emphasizing really abstract or complex theory. The main thing for most progressives about Democratic Party leadership, I've often said, I'd be so thrilled to live under the 2008 Obama-Biden platform.
Right.
And I don't need I don't so much need somebody to go beyond that. I just need somebody who says that and means it. You know, that was, you know, a robust public option and a living wage and comprehensive anti-corruption measures and other political reform measures. and climate change. But it just, you know, give me any one of those platforms, but this time really mean it and let us know that you mean it. There are a set of ideas. Trump on an infrastructure program, he hasn't introduced one. Healthcare, he hasn't introduced one. He said he'd be for minimum wage at different points. It didn't, you know, obviously against it. And these are all things that people understand pretty easily. They're absolute meat and potatoes. Nobody needs to get the monarch notes to your latest proposal. You just have to let them know what simple choices they're making and how badly they're making them. And so what do you really think? You want to give Trump the credit for the Obama economy? I don't care. Go ahead. But are you really telling me that another massive tax cut for the rich is what's going to bring your jobs back? If that's what you believe, he's your guy. I get it. Do you not see that he's done COVID all for himself at other people's expense? And above all, that it won't work, that you have to do the masking. He's out doing unmasked, undistanced indoor rallies, and it's 8 months, 9 months in. He's still doing it. And then asking everybody else why they can't reopen the economy while he's undermining them. Well, there's two choices here. And again, you got to make a choice. And the public is already there. The public just can't believe that we're not all there yet. Okay, the leaders aren't there. That's the greatest frustration, mm-hmm. is that this is not a conflicted country. For in the great majority, 2/3 of this country knows exactly what it wants to do about most of the most important issues, all ready to go, wrapped up and tied with a bow. And it's just all ready. And all we got to do is grab it and run with it right now. And, you know, again, I just say about regarding climate change, what you said, Arnie, this is the greatest jobs program in history.
Absolutely.
We in the 1990s, the United States was able to lead the transformation to an information technology boom. And it profited tremendously. We had Microsoft and everything. We were the leaders in technology in the world. No question about it. And we made a fortune doing it, at least in the aggregate. We didn't as all as individuals. But the country made a lot of money that its failed democracy then failed to distribute, but the money was there. This time the money's not gonna be there because we're lagging so far behind an even bigger transformation, the transformation to sustainable economics based on renewable energy. That's the great paradigm shift of the last 100 years. It has the added benefit of being necessary to avert catastrophe. It's right there. Just lay out the differences everywhere you go every day. And we'll be fine.
Well, and that's why I was actually very excited. And even some of the reporters were kind of shocked at how Biden literally took the fires and turned it into jobs. He turned it into jobs. And that's brilliant. Because people, and as I mentioned to you before, we are going to actually see the smoke from the West Coast arrive in Massachusetts on Tuesday.
Heartbreaking.
On Tuesday. So we're in this together, you know, this is planet ship Earth, you know, and now what's happening out there is not only going to impact us because it's going to devastate those three states financially. It's also the fruit basket. I mean, people don't understand how many things they grow out there. They don't just grow liberals in California and
or even movies.
Or even movies. Exactly right.
And if you don't like the movies, how about the avocados?
Yeah, exactly. Or the almonds. What happens to your almond milk? You know? I mean, and I think that's brilliant. And the other thing is that whether you are tempted to not believe the climate science, you understand a burned out West Coast. Even if you don't believe in the climate science, you're going to see the hurricanes that are impacting Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi. And in the end, that's what's going to be the consequence. It's not even that you have to mention climate change. You just have to say, so how do we freaking fix it? Because there's so much to fix.
And it's not a choice between two policy options. It's a choice between surviving or not.
Exactly.
We either do this, there's not two ways to do this. And again, if you want evidence, there's just what you've talked about. This is no longer, when I was first debating climate change back in the 1990s, we were debating computer models and what they predicted for 30, 40, and 50 years down the road. It turned out that 30, 40, and 50 were 10, 20, and 30 in reality. And now all the evidence is right there on the table. And so there's nothing suppositional about any of this any longer. And not only that, we have Trump's own policies. This is the greatest coal president we could ever have. He's done everything I could imagine anybody doing for the coal industry. We're the only developed nation on earth betting big on coal. How's it going? Okay. It's going this way. It's going this way. There are fewer coal companies and fewer coal employees now than there were because it's over. Because it's over.
Right.
And because the only way out of this is to leave it in the ground.
Right.
And everybody knows. And there's a chance here to deliver massive assistance to Kentucky, to Ohio, to Pennsylvania, to wherever the anthracite and the bituminous, wherever you want to go, every sector of the industry. This is a situation in which there can be transition jobs to safer jobs and jobs that pay as well. That didn't happen in the previous systemic changes in the system. Not all the jobs paid as well when you moved, from agriculture to information to industrial, and especially from industrial to information technology. Here we have a chance for better, more sustainable jobs. The biggest jobs in solar are going to be in maintenance. They're going to be in the 50, and you can't export the maintenance jobs. They're going to be high-skill jobs in solar, in wind, in every type of renewable energy is going to build a permanent professional base, skilled worker base to deal with it. It's time. It's right there. He says it isn't. Here we are. We are, alas, I have to say, we are in a scissors lock between another hurricane in the Gulf and these fires on the coast. And this very day, two more glaciers calving in the Antarctic, forcing up sea levels. The evidence is all on the table. His way's on the table. Just put our way on the table. This is the only way out.
So I've talked about something a lot. There's a program in education called Reading Recovery. What Reading Recovery does is it takes the bottom 20% of readers and it focuses on getting them better at it. They don't have to be coded. They don't have to be special ed. They're just at the bottom. And they focus on them and then they bring them up and then they go to the next 20%. So they're constantly bringing the bottom up in order to make sure that everyone is a better reader. Here's what I want for energy. I want energy recovery. What I want to do is, you talk about, solar and wind and all the alternatives. You know, one of the best alternatives is conservation. All right. So I want to go into every house and every business and say, before we even, as they're worrying about the solar and the alternatives, let's make sure that you're sipping energy. Let's make sure that your house is actually efficient. And that would create millions of jobs because we have so much old architecture and so many buildings that need to be retrofitted and changed. And that's a job that people can do without an incredible skill set, Bill. People are so afraid of those high-tech jobs. There are a lot of low-tech jobs that should have happened yesterday.
There's no question that's true. An old friend of mine, Joel Gord, is a great environmental activist and great and knowledgeable environmental activist in Connecticut and in the country, has been saying to me for years that it's sort of a, in some ways, an uncomfortable paradox, but conservation dollar, if you want to spend a dollar to fight climate change, the dollar with the most benefit, the best cost benefit ratio, even today, is still insulation. Okay. It is still getting better storm windows. It is still fixing the air gaps in your doors and windows. And so, there is massive employment. And again, when we talk about a Green New Deal, first of all, it's a phrase more than a program. And because it's a phrase, it's easy for them in some ways to speak against it on the other side. And then when you say, however, that you want a massive infrastructure program and you want weatherization and you realize that solar and wind are the only cost-efficient alternative to keep this economy moving and to help it expand, they don't have anything to say. As soon as it's even that specific,
right,
there's not much to say on the other side because it's all self-evidently true. Solar is already less expensive than oil. The fossil fuels in the marketplace, all we have to do is unleash it. I'll just say about one thing about it. There are transition costs, same as with healthcare. When you when you switch to a new paradigm, you have to spend a fair amount of money up front to get the new system in place. Mm-hmm. And it's true of any major paradigm shift. And the two biggest paradigm shifts we face are energy and healthcare in terms of their expense. But the transition is all about helping people with installations, small businesses, family, getting back those tax credits that Koch brothers are traveling all over the country trying to eliminate.
Right.
Damn the family, you know, damn them for doing it.
Yeah.
And so all we have to do is help people through that transition. Technology, all there, all ready to go,
And on healthcare, as horrific as the pandemic is, it's actually helping the argument. Because what I posted the other day was, people are looking at the number of people that have died. I am looking at the healthcare costs of people that will have lived through COVID-19. Because they're going to live with permanent conditions, heart conditions, lung conditions, nerve conditions. And those are all pre-existing. We already have a lot of people with pre-existing conditions anyway. And these are even people that don't even evidence that they have COVID-19, but they may in fact have gotten COVID-19. And how will we know? Because they will have permanent heart damage. And we will find that out. And that in a lot of ways is supporting us to look at transitioning into a different kind of healthcare future. In addition to which, the fires, you know this, the fires mean the air is polluted. It means it's harder to breathe. It only exacerbates what's happening with the pandemic. Because if we already know what the pandemic is causing, we know that it becomes even more acute in a polluted situation. Guess what we just did? We just created this universal pollution across the entire West Coast, a place that was neurotic about how clean their air was. And now because of the fires, guess what? They're kind of like certain places in Houston, hard to breathe.
Trump is out in the California as we speak, repeating his inspiring message that he first did it in 2018 and 2019, that if only we did more raking, that this problem, that there's a huge raking deficit among Democratic governors, that it's not that it was 121 degrees in Los Angeles this week. That's not it. It's that they should rake, Yosemite. I mean, they should be out raking their forest floors more often. And, you know, there may be something. He said he got this from the president of Finland, who then went back in 2008. He said, I talked to the president of Finland, and their forests are spotless, you know. And I'm sure they are. The Scandinavians are hygienic in every level, I think. But the president, basically, it's hard for me to translate. I don't know Finnish. But the president of Finland said, huh? I forget what language that
is.
Huh? And of course, it's just not true. And all these lies, all of Trump's lies have never mattered more in real time. They're killing people right now. And what we see in the fires and the hurricanes is a glimpse of the magnitude of the carnage to come. This is the thing about climate change that people should begin to keep in mind. It is far, far greater in its potential injury to our species than COVID. COVID is a test run. This is a shakedown cruise for what it's going to be like if in fact climate change continues unabated in this world right now. And no one should be afraid to say it with feeling and clarity and strength and purpose. And above all, as I said before, let people know not just that you're name-checking a big issue for liberals, but that you really mean it. Well, you mean it, right. And you're going to act.
And that's why Biden was brilliant when he said to them, so what are you worried about in suburbia? What you're worried about that is that your house is going to burn down. That's what you're worried about. You need to understand what the priority is. And the thing you should fear, that's the thing you should fear. I thought that was just a brilliant flip on Donald Trump. He took his issue and then he shredded his issue. And he made it an issue where people can actually smell the smoke, see the fire, see the people devastated, going, where am I going to go home to? And recognizing, as I told you again, we are going to actually see the smoke from the West Coast on Tuesday in Massachusetts. What does that tell you about our connection? It's amazing, Bill. It's amazing.
It tells us we're going to get through this. I pray every day now. And I Bernie's right. And we need to get out there on pocketbook issues, on economic justice issues in the specific, and on political reform in the specific. And we have to let people know that we're the only ones, again, for all of its warts and blemishes, the Democratic Party is the only vehicle through which we're ever going to actually drain the swamp. It's a pretty swampy entity itself. I live my life in it. I know.
And I need
but
to
all the impulses for reform are within it right now. And we need to control the Senate and the White House so that the progressive movements that are arising in this country can actually make the government change.
And the reason I call Bill Curry is because he's the way I practice hope. So thank you so much for joining us. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
All right. God, you know that Ken Barnes to behave, okay?
Yeah, all right. Do I owe you?
That's why I told her to call you, Bill. Yeah. That's why I told her to call you. You're the guy.
Ciao. Talk to you guys tomorrow.
All right, guys. Take care.
One morning I woke up and I knew it was wrong. A new day, a new way, and new eyes.